I'm Judith McKay, and this is Voices and Views. And today I have the distinct pleasure of talking with Constance Squires, a current author who lives in Oklahoma, and with John Lewis, the author and editor of the Amalgre Review. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Hi, Judith.
Hi, John. Hi, Constance.
Hi, Judith.
So basically we're going to be talking about your story, Constance. Being a current author, what led you to write? How did this all begin?
Well, I don't feel that I had too much choice about it, you know. It just seemed like it was always what I wanted to do. I was a big reader as a kid, and to me the authors were these mysterious shadow figures behind the books that I read, and I couldn't think of anyone it would be better to be than to be one of those people, you know, one of those authors, to have your name on the spine of a book, you know, to be able to be found in a library card catalog. I mean, that was just my world, and so those people were my idols. This is always what I wanted to do. So it wasn't a really very direct route, but I was an English major in college at the University of Oklahoma, which didn't have a creative writing program. So I was just, you know, reading and studying literature and everything. And it wasn't really until I got into a master's program that I had instructors who were working writers, who were published authors and things like that. It made it seem possible, you know, because being a writer isn't like being anything else. There isn't a real clear career path. You know, you can't get a creative writing degree and then rent an office and open the doors and expect to make money somehow. I mean, it's a real mystery when you're trying to do it. You think, how do you do this? How does anyone do it? Until I really met people who were doing it and who could show me the way, it was hard for me to believe that I could do it or believe in myself. But then, you know, I'd been writing all the way along and reading all the way along, and so finally I was able to just sort of jump in with both feet, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And once I started to publish, then it felt like I had some external validation for what up to then maybe seemed like an unfortunate preoccupation. You know, I thought, look, I am what I say I am. I can prove it. So
you have the credentials now.
I do, right.
You're showing up in black and white.
Yeah, yeah. And you need that at the beginning, you know, because you know, you're thinking, this is my one and only life. And if I'm not very good at this, I really need to know because I need to get on with something. And so, you know, when it started to work out, I thought, oh, good, because I would be really sad if the only thing I ever wanted to do in my life was not something I could do. So
very poignant.
Yeah.
John, again, I want to thank you for introducing us to Constance Squires.
Well, it's my pleasure, Judith. Constance is obviously a very talented author and writer, and I had the good fortune of discovering her in one of the literary journals out of Oklahoma called Arcadia. And I was reading through an issue from a couple years ago, and there was one story in particular that really stuck out. When I read it, it just emotionally kind of grabbed me by my collars and pulled me in. So I did the old Facebook ploy. I reached out and said, "Hey, I read your story and it was wonderful." And she responded back, and that's kind of how we struck up a correspondence. And then I was able to tease her into an interview in our last issue of the Amalgre Review.
John, if people wanted to get a hold of this Amalgre Review, which you put out quarterly, I believe, how would they do that?
It's a twice a year publication. It's available in bookstores around town, and then we have our website, thealmagrereview.org, where one can go in and purchase copies. So we're a small local project right now, and we really try to highlight local talent here in Colorado Springs, Denver, Front Range area. But we also know that our readers here love to hear wonderful writers from all over. So that's why we have authors like Constance Squires in there, and other authors. We've had writers from Canada, New York, Europe, India.
I will look forward to more, John. So, Constance, I love the beginning of your story. It's exciting and it's...
Thank you.
So, carry on.
I worked on a novel during my master's degree, and the whole time I was working on it, people would say in a slightly pitying way, you know, Connie, a lot of people have to write a starter novel. And it made me very angry because it was so hard, you know. It's very, very hard to write a novel. And I revised it and rewrote it over and over and over again for several years. And I would send it out, and I was trying to get an agent, And I had so many close calls and so many honorable mentions and novel contests and things that it was hard for me to let go of it. And I don't know that I ever would have, but finally I started a PhD program where we were writing short fiction. And that was a joy. It was like being let out of jail because I had been struggling with this one novel, which was one voice, one character, one sensibility, for so long, and I was so tired of it. I didn't realize how tired of it I was. And short fiction is so joyous because there's just this great freedom. You do not have to sustain the voice for 300 pages. So I felt free to be really outrageous in my characterizations and things because I thought, I don't have to pull this off for very long, you know? And I just need to, it's much more of a sprint than a long distance run. And I loved it. I loved the form. And so I started writing short stories and then I started publishing them and good things happened. And so when I had a short story collection, it was basically my dissertation for my PhD. I got an agent after one of those stories was published in The Atlantic. And the agent tried to sell that collection, and he didn't sell it, but four editors at the big houses in New York all said the same thing, which was there are three or four stories in this collection that are about an American military family overseas, based in Germany, and we don't really have that in our literature yet, you know, no one's really written about that, and yet there have been millions of people stationed in Germany since the end of World War II, and so that would be an interesting project. My agent asked me if I would consider writing a short story cycle, you know, sort of a connected cycle like Love Medicine by Louise Erdrich or Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson, that sort of thing. And I, you know, I loved that idea. I had plenty of material. So I did that. I spent a couple years writing connected stories, and my agent took it to those editors, and Riverhead bought it, which is a division of Penguin Publishing. But they said, you know, novels sell a lot better than short story collections. Would you convert it into a novel? And I, of course, was more than happy to do it. I was absolutely thrilled to have a contract with Riverhead. But I sort of thought, you know, I wish they'd said that sooner because it would have been a lot easier to write a novel than it would have been to have all those connected stories. But I did that. And so that became Along the Watchtower. That was the first one. And then I've been working on stories, and I've got a short story collection coming out next spring called Hit Your Brights. And I had a second novel called Life from Medicine Park come out in October. And then I'm working on another one, you know, it's just plugging away at it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, what was the name of your first book?
Along the Watchtower.
Along the Watchtower. What is that about?
The title? Oh. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously there's that the song reference, All Along the Watchtower, which I think most people connect with Jimi Hendrix, although it is a Dylan song originally, and which is called All Along the Watchtower. It resonates a lot with the setting of the book, which is an army base that's just about 20 or 30 kilometers from the Czech border during the Cold War. So it was basically along the wall of the Iron Curtain, and the watchtowers of the Iron Curtain are mentioned in the book. And so after about a 30 title list, my editors sort of chose that one, and I said, okay. I had so many different titles for that book, but that's the one they went with, and I think that's fine. I'm okay with it.
You're good.
So, yeah.
When you write, where do you get your information from? Is it just through total research? Is it something that just speaks to your heart and soul, or is it from stories that you've experienced and there's a connection in your life that just resonates that you need to tell that story? How does that show up?
Well, that's a good question. It's never research first. I always am a little disappointed when I realize I'm going to have to do research, because for me it's really about voice. That's what happens first, is I have a voice, and usually it's a voice with a problem. There's no fiction without trouble, you know, without tension of some sort. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I usually just have a voice that's maybe trying to rationalize and justify a behavior that wasn't okay, or trying to explain why something happened the way it did, and you know, that voice just leads me into a question, and that question really becomes the plot of the story, you know. Sometimes it's a question that I'm asking myself, and then sometimes it's a question that the characters are overtly searching for. You know, they're searching their way through a set of circumstances that, I mean, the classic thing about fiction is that the character has to change. They have to change or refuse to change. I sort of resist these dogmatic, prescriptive ideas about fiction, but really, honestly, I don't know too many circumstances when that's not good advice. That's pretty good advice, you know? And so I begin thinking about, there's usually something I don't know about a situation. By following it into where I don't know, things just arise that I wouldn't have thought of, you know, that wouldn't have come to me. And then I do research where I need to, you know. Mm-hmm. So the novel I'm working on right now involves, it scares me because it's more ambitious in terms of a responsibility to the wider world than anything I've written before. It has two timelines, and one is current and involves fracking in Oklahoma, which is a big deal in Oklahoma right now. And, well, I mean, worldwide, you know. And then also it involves the Oklahoma City bombing, the Murrah bombing in 1995. I have to do research for those things. I have to get those right. And I feel a real responsibility to get that stuff right. But I try to write everything I can and then do the research later, you know. Yeah, because I don't want to inhibit the voice. And then sometimes the research will change the course of things a little bit, you know. Hopefully not too much, I hope. Mm-hmm. I think we write the sort of thing we want to read, and I have read so many books where I've thought, wow, they got overwhelmed by their research, and that they just love those details and couldn't leave them out, but the story just died. You know, I've had that experience a lot as a reader. Maybe that's just me, but so I try not to do that. I try to give just enough information to further the story, but not to bog it down.
I like that. And listening to you, I hear that as I read. There's some things that I read that I just can't put the book down. And then there's other authors that, well, I feel like I'm being educated because there's so much research in it that I just went back to school. And that's okay, too, depending on the subject and how much time I have.
Yeah, but, definitely. It's just a choice about style, I think.
It is, isn't it? And how much I really want to learn about this particular subject. So, sometimes it's nice to have that balanced. I was reading a little bit of your bio. Actually, I was reading everything I could get a hold of to learn more about Constance Squires. And one of the interesting things that caught my attention was when you were getting ready to write your book, you were on a train going through Italy.
Oh, yeah. That was actually a blurb that another author wrote about reading live from Medicine Park. It was very flattering. John Domini said that while he was reading live from Medicine Park, he felt like he was in Oklahoma and looked up to be surprised to find he was in Italy, which was very flattering. I was very grateful to him for that blurb.
That was fun about how that connection and how you write too, and however that shows up whether you're on a train, wherever you are, how you start putting pen to paper. And saying that, how do you write? Do you write on the computer? Do you write with a pen on a yellow pad? And do you have an outline? How does that start to metamorph?
Well, I write on the computer mainly because I just know that if I write things by hand, they will probably never get fully revised and finished enough to send out. It's just faster for me to write on the computer. And I've heard people say that they think differently writing on the computer, but I don't think I do. I think I'm fine writing that way. And as far as outlining, I don't do that. And I think I'm with the novel I'm working on right now, The Real Remains. I think I need to a little bit, you know, because it has a more ambitious plot structure that I'm just going to have to keep a hold of all the threads a little bit. But I was always taught, and I really believe that the fiction really takes off at the moment things start to happen that the author did not anticipate. And so I really think that outlining can shut that down. And when I teach, I try to tell students that. I mean, I tell them, if you're writing a scene in which you have a certain idea about what needs to happen, and your characters begin to do things that you did not expect them to do, Let them do that. Let them go. Because the moment, it just became airborne. It just lifted off. And if you shut that down and plod along with what your conscious mind thought needed to happen, then you've shut out your subconscious. And your subconscious is a thousand times stronger and more interesting than anything your conscious mind can come up with. And so I try to, you know, to leave that wide open for myself in my fiction. The more I write, the more I realize I need to cede a little bit of ground to pre-planning and organization, you know, just because I've taken so many wrong turns that I had to backtrack and, you know, delete 100 pages that I think I could have avoided if I thought it out a little more clearly beforehand. So,
well, it's just part of the experience of writing, the education.
It is, no way out but through, you know, you have to do it, see what happens.
We have to do that, don't we? Yeah. That's all part of the process of learning and growing and having fun.
Yeah.
Judith, I'm wondering if I can jump in and ask a question here, since we have Constance in the studio. The book you're working on, Fracking and the Murrah bombing, the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yeah.
So every story, small or large, the ones that have the energy that can sustain us through a project, has a very strong conception, usually.
Yeah.
Where did that come from? Because what does one have to do with the other?
Good question. Yeah. Well, what it is that there are two different timelines. I wrote a really short piece for the Rolling Stone 500 about the whole album, Live Through This, which. I don't know how I could explain this, but it's about two college girls who are who wake up in Oklahoma City on the morning of the Oklahoma City bombing. One of them goes down to the Social Security office to get a new Social Security card to start a new job, and is down there at the time of the bombing. And so it's told from the point of view of her roommate and her boyfriend who was at the apartment. They don't know what happened to her. You know, they just know that they realize, they hear the bomb go off, and a couple of hours later they realize that was the building where the Social Security office was. And so all through the day the body count is coming in, and it's becoming national news, and they do not know where she is, and she hasn't come home. And so they sneak down to the bombing site, which is all, you know, security and FBI and ATF and everything is down there. But they sneak in because they figure that if his car is there, then it means that she was in the building and she may be gone. And so that little story became, I thought, I'm just not done with these characters. And in the little, it's a little bit of microfiction. It's about 1,500 words. And in that, she turns up okay. But in my novel, I just kept thinking, what if she didn't turn up? What if she didn't turn up? Mm-hmm. And yet the real body count is a real body count, and I can't mess with that. You know, I can't insert someone, you know, that mm-hmm. didn't actually, I mean, the people who lived through that would not appreciate it, you know? And so I thought, well, then what would it be if she actually was or wasn't? And so that it grew from there. And so there's a second storyline, which is these two characters, the roommate and the ex-boyfriend, have become man and wife, and it's 20 years later, and they're moving back to Oklahoma City, and the woman is a public relations person for an oil company. At the moment when the oil companies are working really hard to deny that fracking has anything to do with the sudden rash of earthquakes all around Oklahoma. You know, this has been, I think it's been happening in Colorado too, hasn't it? Some of this drilling.
A lot of northeastern part of the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's, in the current timeline, she's dealing with that. She's dealing with having to be the face on the news that denies what she herself knows is a lie, and denies what's happening. So that's her struggle in real time. But the story opens with her receiving a Facebook notification of a friend invitation from her friend who she thought died in the bombing. And so they don't know if it's a cruel joke or what is happening. And so that propels the story forward, is they're trying to figure out, what is she alive? Could she be? Or, you know, what's really going on? And there was a lot that I wondered if it could work out. But it turned out that the secretary, the administrative assistant for my English department, her husband was the head of OSBI's forensics unit that was at the bombing site. And so I was able to ask him some questions, you know, would it be possible for someone to really not know? And he told me some things that really helped me make my plot plausible, that were amazing. And so, yeah, that's how they connect, hopefully.
Yeah, no, that's
we'll
interesting.
See. We'll
that's
see.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So as you're telling the story, do you know how it's going to end, or is it just going to continually unfold and these people show up and the story continues however it's going to show up?
Yeah.
How does that work for you?
Well, I mean, this really speaks to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. I do not know how it's going to end. I really don't. But I have a few ideas. And I think that for each main character, I know what their question is and what their story arc is, what they need to have some sort of resolution about. And so there's only a few ways that it can go, but I don't know what, I don't know how it's going to fall. I really don't. I think I can see about 100 pages ahead, but I can't see the ending yet.
Okay.
So, well, I don't know. We'll see.
That's exciting because I can totally understand that.
Yeah.
So once you finish your first draft, what do you do then?
I usually give it to someone to read and try to get some feedback on it and then start revising it.
Mm-hmm.
It usually takes several drafts, sometimes more than that, before something is ready. And then, and then the fun part of trying to get it published. So
let's talk about publishing then, since you brought that famous word up, publishing. we both know there's the large publishing houses and then there's the small ones. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, well, I've recently had experience with both. My first novel came out, like I said, with Riverhead Penguin, and then my second novel came out with the University of Oklahoma Press, and they're going to bring out my short story collection, too. And I don't know, you know, what will happen with the one I'm still writing. You know, who knows if I'll ever even finish it, although I think I will. You know, and so I've experienced both of them, and I don't know. I mean, there's really pros and cons to both, but the big New York publishing is, it really is, I think that there are a lot of wonderful people working in it. Every editor that I've worked with was wonderful and really cared about the work, and the agents really care about the work. Most agents that I've encountered seem to be people with MFAs in creative writing, so they really love it. They love the work that they're championing and stuff, but the bottom line is that all those wonderful people are working for number crunchers, you know what I mean? And so when my first book was taken at Riverhead, yeah, the editor left right as soon as they acquired the book. And so I didn't really have a champion within the publishing house. And so the book was really well reviewed, but it didn't sell a ton. And then when it came time for the second one, the only thing they look at is how many the first book sold. And if it's below a certain number, they will not take you on. Period. I mean, they just won't. And so that's what happened to me. And that's a very common thing. I know a lot of people in my position. The University of Oklahoma has been wonderful. They sort of have just recently started a new fiction imprint. They're sort of famous for their Native American history and a lot of, you know, fiction. I mean, nonfiction, but they've been great and have been really supportive and wonderful. But there's, you know, there's definitely drawbacks. I mean, when you have a book that's got a national press, it's a lot easier to just call up any bookstore and get a reading. Whereas with a smaller press, they may sort of act like, well, I don't know, you know. And so I don't know. I think that there's... It's a hard moment for publishing. It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. But I think it's a lot like music. I think a lot of the indie labels are out there doing a lot of really good music, whereas the great big labels are doing the real risk-averse, formulaic pop stuff that's guaranteed hits. It's the same thing with fiction. You know, if you're writing thrillers, you're going to be all right. You know, you're going to get a big press and you're going to make a lot of money. But if you're writing anything more nuanced or less cookie cutter, it's a little less certain, but not grim, you know. I think if you do good work, it's going to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll find the places and it'll find its audience.
That's very encouraging. Well, of course, then we hear too about self-publishing.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I don't have any experience with it, but I have definitely watched its reputation morph and change dramatically in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, it used to just be synonymous with vanity presses. You know, it usually just meant someone who probably wasn't up to a professional level of writing, but just wanted to get something out there before it was ready. But it doesn't mean that anymore, you know? There are just so many people that are being let down by the publishing houses that a lot of self-publishing is some really worthwhile stuff. And some of those self-publishers are quite savvy at marketing and are really showing people how to do it, you know, getting tremendous fan bases and stuff. And there's now this retroactive thing where a big publishing house will find indie people that have independently published and give them big contracts after they've already, you know, shown that they can sell a lot of books. So it's interesting. It's a really interesting moment in publishing. I think nobody really knows what's going on. You know?
No one does.
Yeah. Yeah. I think keep an open mind is the only thing you can say.
Do you have a favorite author that you always go back to or that really has inspired you?
Oh, I do. I have a ton of them, but right now I'm rereading some Iris Murdoch. She is just not at all cool, but I love her. You know, she was an English writer who was a philosopher and wrote 26 novels. And I don't write anything like her, and I don't know why I like her, but I love her stories, and I love the structures that she builds inside her novels. And so I've been going back to her and reading one of her novels that I somehow missed. Yeah, she's very inspiring.
Mm-hmm. I've read a couple of them, but I think I will read more, too. She's quite the author. What would you say to an inspiring writer?
I would say don't be discouraged, but also don't fool yourself. It's awfully difficult, but it's awfully rewarding, too. You know, it will be much harder than it should be. You know, the world needs all of our voices. You know, it may feel like it's sort of fruitless. You may feel like nobody's listening and nobody's reading, but it's not true. It's not mm-hmm. true, you know.
Thank you for saying that. That's so important. We need to hear our voices. So, Constance Squires, if someone wanted to learn more about your work and how to get a hold of your books, how would they do that?
Well, my website is ConstanceSquiresOfficial.com, which I had to add the official because someone had jacked my name for some reason. Anyway, so that there's information there. But then also, you know, just any bookstore will carry Along the Watchtower and Live from Medicine Park. Or even if they don't have them in stock, they'll be able to order them. And so they're readily available. And then I've got a lot of stories that can be found online as well. And then Hit Your Brights should be out in spring of 2019. And I have high hopes for that. I'm hoping that will be a lot of fun.
Oh, I think so, from what you have shared with us. And it sounds like you're just having fun doing this.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun, definitely.
And when you teach your writing classes, too, I'm sure you have a lot of fun with that and how you get inspired with that and inspire the students.
Oh, yes, students are inspiring. It's just helpful to watch them go through it. It makes you connect with your own process. Mm-hmm. It's very fruitful, yeah.
Good. It's been a pleasure talking with you. This was way too fast, but I'm so glad you were here and sharing your story with us, and the very best to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Judith. Thank you, John.
Thanks, John, thank you, for being here and making this happen.
No, thank you, Judith. I really, really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.